Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lady Justice is a true crime podcast. Therefore, deals with incidents of violence, disturbing imagery, and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised. The Lady Justice podcast wishes to offer their deepest condolences to the victims' families and wishes to offer thanks to those that work in emergency services. Hello, my lovelies, and welcome to yet another episode of Lady Justice, a true crime podcast. Lady Justice is a weekly podcast that covers fascinating cases from both the past and the present. My name is Chantel, and I'm your friendly true crime junkie with slight caffeine addiction issues. I hope this episode finds you all feeling great and that you're having a brilliant week. As usual, before I get into this episode, I do want to ask you guys a massive favour. Please support this podcast by subscribing, rating, and leaving a review where you can. And because sharing is caring, I want you to tell everyone you know. Share it on social media and get the word out. It really does make the world of difference. If you would like to contact me about anything, please feel free to do so via social media or by my email, which you'll find in the show notes. We are now into the third episode in the collection of stories from Teesside, and I am overwhelmed by the fantastic response I have had from listeners, so I wish to thank all of you for listening, sharing, and getting in touch with your thoughts. In the first episode, we took a look into the case of a serial sexual assaulter, Timothy Dinn. And in the last episode, we took a look at the loner, Eric Yale, who murdered 18-month-old Stevie McLeary at a house party in Middlesbrough. This episode also carries an extra trigger warning as it involves violence against a child, so please practice self-care and only continue if you feel like you can. This week, before the act of kindness, we have a promo from a voice from Teesside itself, the glorious Fern from Evidence of a Crime. Fern is a dedicated host who always strives and delivers great episodes on some of the most shocking crimes. I particularly wish to highlight that you can listen to her episodes on Carl Bridgewater, Justice for Jacob, and the Seeking Justice episode on DJ Finkley. Her promo will be played a little later in the show. Now, in this week's episode. Love, it can be all-consuming and glorious, but it can also be to our detriment. What happens when you are so blinded by somebody that you go to grave extremes to make them look at you and no other? This is the case, Love Triangle. So, without further ado, here is some of the background on the location and time frame of this case. We are heading back to 1974, when the UK had another election in which Edward Heath lost to who he had defeated just 4 years before, Harold Wilson, giving him his second premiership. It was the year that saw The Pink Cat, Bagpuss air on the BBC for the first time, and the year that saw Lord Lucan mysteriously disappear after a murder. Brighton held the Eurovision Song Contest, with Swedish legends ABBA winning with the song Waterloo. 1974 saw the births of Sporty Spice Mel C, Twitter god James Blunt, and the mother of dragons Emilia Fox. The year saw celebrity deaths of Ed Sullivan, H.G. Bates, and Nobel Prize-winning physicist James Chadwick. We are taking a trip to Stockton-on-Tees, the home to the first public railway to use steam locomotives. It's an ancient town that has had a settlement for many years. There was once a medieval castle located on the bank of the River Tees, where the Castlegate Shopping Centre now stands on the High Street. Stockton is also known to be the home of the oldest fossilised remains of the most northerly hippo found in 1958, and as mentioned in the first episode of Teesside Terrace, it's the location of the Category B prison home house. Famous folk with connections to the town include Lee Cattermole, Jimmy James, and George Orwell, who resided in the area towards the end of the Second World War. As always, all my sources will be listed in the show notes. It wasn't late in the afternoon of Monday the 11th of February in 1974 that Catherine Spickett realised her 10-year-old son Paul wasn't home from school at his usual time. She knew he'd been saving for a new pedal bike and had been walking part of the way home to Falcon Way in the town of Thornaby, instead of using the bus that he had usually. The lamps were already starting to illuminate the streets when she started to call around friends, family and the school before realising not one person had seen him since a school friend had seen him a little over a mile away in the town centre. Kathy, as she was known by friends, called the police, who reported the dark-haired, fresh-faced boy as missing. Police officers asked Paul's mother, who was by now in the early evening in an increasingly panicked emotion, where the boy may have gone. Was all okay at home? It is not unusual for children to run away. Kathy told the uniformed officers that Paul, despite being happy, may have tried to get to his father's home, as she had separated from him recently. The officers of Cleveland Police sent out an alert along the routes that led to Benwell in the northern city of Newcastle-upon-Tyne, in case the boy had tried to use the train system or hitchhiked. Durham Constabulary and Northumberland Police were on alert, with a photo of the happy boy from his school photo. Catherine, as a single mother, was working as a conductress on the buses, and so was a popular figure in the community. When the news quickly spread that Paul was missing, many people started to check the streets from the school to his home. They also checked the local parks and nature areas that surrounded the town tucked in by the River Tees. One of the drivers she regularly worked on that took them on a route connecting the towns of Thornaby and Stockton, Brian Adams, was to get a call from the concerned mother and left a message for someone to watch his own children after work and went to help with the search efforts for her primary age schoolboy. That first night was to give no clue to where Paul was. His father waited anxiously by the front window of his Bishop's Road home after receiving the news, yet the boy never appeared. By the second day, children and teachers from his school were interviewed, yet no one had a clue where Paul may have gone. He showed no indication of wanting to leave, and seemed like a perfectly normal, happy boy. The lives of those involved with Paul started to be suspected, and those who were actively trying to help the family with the searches had their names checked. Local creeps were spoken to, and appeals were made along the many routes that the boy could have taken home. Yet no one saw Paul. None of his belongings, his fur-lined parka coat or school bag had been found. Paul had vanished into thin air. Brian Adams, the bus driver who was helping with the search, was spoken to as it became clear early in the investigation that he was dating Kathy, and anyone new in the boy's life would naturally be suspicious. Yet, he had a good relationship with the boy, and there was no issues in the adult's relationship thus far, so it was ruled out. The days passed until on Valentine's Day, Thursday the 14th, a bread delivery man was driving along the road that connected Stockton-on-Tees to the town of Sedgefield. Just after dawn, John Ralph was near the village of Thorpe Thews in County Durham when he spotted something in a ditch by the grass verge of the road. John stopped and moved towards the object, but retracted in horror when he saw the mangled body of a small child with a plastic supermarket carrier bag over his head. The police were informed, and the child was taken to the local hospital infirmary. The detectives on the scene suspected they knew who the child was, but formal identification was needed, and the tough job of collecting the 44-year-old Catherine Spickett to view the body was made. The beaten and slashed body by the A177 road was that of her 10-year-old son, Paul. As detectives set up a mobile headquarters near the boy's home in Thornaby, a few miles away, the county pathologist was conducting a post-mortem at Stockton General. It was discovered that the boy had died due to sustaining multiple injuries to his head and face. The object was considered most likely to be a heavy hammer, with both the blunt and sharp ends of the head being used, approximately 7 times. Police that had attended the scene found that due to the position of Paul's body when he was found, that his killer had most likely dumped him in a hurry under the cover of darkness by pushing him out of a vehicle. The investigation was led by the deputy head of Teesside CID, Detective Superintendent Norman Hudson, and he was to make a statement to the press on the developments of the case thus far. It was said that despite Paul suffering a horrendous attack, that they did not believe it to be a sexually motivated crime, as there was no indication that the boy had suffered any sexual assault. He also stated there was now a team of 80 officers carrying out a full-scale murder inquiry. The fear that was felt in the community is perfectly summed up by a statement made by Detective Chief Superintendent Jack Collinson, head of Durham County CID, who commented, "As long as the murderer is not found, we don't know what he will do." Not knowing if this was a drifter who had picked up Paul, someone who knew him, or somebody who they could have possibly passed in the street on a daily basis, made parents around Thornaby nervous. And mothers escorted their children to school. For all they knew, it could have been their neighbour who killed Paul. Detectives made appeals through the local press and surrounding counties for anybody to help trace Paul's movements that Monday afternoon. That's when a tip came into the station that would blow the whole investigation open. And by Monday the 18th of February, 2 people were appearing at Teesside Magistrates Court in Middlesbrough, charged with the murder of Paul Spickett. When the names were printed in the press, shock truly came over the Teesside towns, who pride themselves on having each other's backs. Granted legal aid and remanded until trial at Teesside Crown Court was local familiar face Brian Bernard Adams, 37, and his 31-year-old wife, Isabel Adams, a former schoolteacher and mother of 4. Brian Adams also being Kathy Spickett's partner. They were to be taken to Durham Prison and Low Newton Remand Centre respectively. Their 4 children were to be cared for by another, as their childhood home was now a crime scene. The couple had been married since 1965 in the now defunct county of Cumberland. Detectives discovered that this was no perfect marriage, as Brian had bore a child to a different woman during an affair. Isabel knew of this and had forgiven him. But that was not the strangest thing about their relationship, which is what unfortunately led to the horrific murder of an innocent child. Before we start the trial section and discover the events that surround this crime, ask yourself, what would you do to be noticed? How far would you go for love? The Adams couple were to appear on trial on the 6th of July 1974, in proceedings overseen by Mr. Justice Mays. Mr. Derek Clarkson, Queen's Counsel for the prosecution, was going to outline a case of an odd love triangle that ended in murder. He stated that Isabel's blind affection for her husband drove her to kill her husband's lover's son. Dubbed a Romeo type, Brian had somehow convinced his wife to pose as his sister and let him continue his affair with Catherine. The ruse was set up by Brian after he fell for the older woman after they had met at work. He told Isabel of the affection he had for Kathy and said that she should pose as his sister-in-law. He then told Kathy he was the widowed father of two girls after his wife had died the previous year in a car crash, and his now dead and, well, non-existent brother's wife helped in caring for them with her two own girls. This went as far as when the Adams children were introduced to Mrs. Spickett as to call their own parents Auntie and Uncle. This relationship was long-lasting, and the trio were often seen socialising in many public houses in the area, with Isabel agreeing and acting like her husband was just her brother and that his lover had found the perfect man. They would play darts together, and Isabel said her name was Miss Craig. Before the end of their evenings and the closing time bell was rung, Isabel would leave alone and go back to their Londonderry Road home in the Newtown area of Stockton to attend to their children, whilst Brian would go to Kathy's home in Thornaby. Clarkson continued, "It is a bizarre case. This man spent his time between two women. Mrs. Adams clearly knew of her husband's associations, and to some extent, condoned it." The strange love triangle was almost discovered by Kathy when she became suspicious and checked the electoral roll, when she found that Isabel wasn't Isabel Craig, but Isabel Adams. She confronted the pair, who stated that she preferred to go by her maiden name. After an argument and Kathy still not convinced of the lie, Brian doctored a false marriage record that stated Isabel was married to Michael Adams, which seemed to work, as Catherine believed they were brother and sister-in-law. Then, shortly after, Mrs. Spickett found a letter that would cast a shadow on her perfect man and his relationship with his sister once again. In the letter written by Isabel to Brian, it said, "My darling Brian, you are a wonderful husband and father." Of course, there was more confrontation. Mrs. Adams wrote to the other woman in a way to try and explain herself. She told Kathy it was just her way of saying thank you for looking after her and the children after her husband Michael's death, ending the note with, "You and Brian seem like an ideal couple." For the defence, Mr. Gilbert Gray, Queen's Counsel, was to say about this note, "The letter was written in abject misery and heartbreak. He was telling his wife that unless she did what he told her and endured these impossible demands, she was out of the picture. It was in the hope that he would return to her that she endured all the deception and finally killed this innocent boy." This innocent boy was known to Isabel. He had met her and was introduced as his mother's boyfriend's sister. He was not fearful of her. She was, after all, a mum herself and a teacher, someone you would trust. So when Paul saw the woman appear near the school and then said that she'd been asked to take him to hers after school, he thought nothing sinister about this. They arrived at her home only to have tragedy strike, as he was ambushed by the love-struck and jealous woman who was wielding the hammer. After she had killed him, she placed him in the inbuilt bedroom cupboard and waited for her husband to come home. Brian didn't arrive until the next morning, having been helping with the search efforts for the boy. When he stepped in the door, she told him, "He's upstairs dead. I did it for you, because of you." The Wednesday night, Brian loaded the body of his wife's victim, his lover's child, into the car and drove 10 miles from the boy's home and dumped him alone. On the Tuesday, Mr. Adams, even knowing that the body of the child he was looking for was in his bedroom, just meters from his bed, still went on searches for Paul with members of the Spickett family. The judge and jury was to hear that during interviews with Detective Chief Inspector Robert Redford, who we met in the previous episode. Isabel Adams tried to shield her husband, taking the blame, saying that she was the one that dumped Paul's body, wearing her husband's clothing. When Brian was interviewed, he stated, "My wife wanted me to be happy and would do anything for me. I know that my carrying on the way I did drove her to this." Evidence was produced with letters from Isabel to her husband, stating such phrases as, "I have given you every ounce of love. What more must I do to get you to leave Kathy and come home to me?" Mr. Gray, in her defence, said, "This pathetic woman was blindly in love with her faithless Don Juan husband, who involved her in the most agent form of deceit. Mrs. Adams was under this tremendous influence and was besotted. Love is supposed to be blind, and in her case, it was. Adams was selfish and egocentric. It never crossed his tiny mind that it would drive his wife to this calamity." Mr. Adams, Brian, ignored his desperate wife, who would wait at bus stops along his route to hand letters to him, with their children in tow, waving silently. Isabel pleaded not guilty to the murder, but guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. Brian admitted to helping her conceal and dispose of the body. The jury found Isabel guilty of murder. Mrs. Spickett was undergoing treatment in the hospital at the time of the trial, so did not see her former lover be sentenced to 12 months in prison. Mr. Justice Mays said to the man, "You behaved abominably to your wife. There is nothing that can be said in your favour. You appear to have a way with women. You goaded your wife into a mental state, ending in killing this boy. Removing the body was not to protect your wife, your concern for Kathy. This might be the end of your affair with her." No shit, Sherlock. Isabel Adams was sentenced on the 8th of July. The mother of four and former schoolteacher was told by Mr. Justice Mays at Teesside Crown Court, "It is one of the most distressing cases I have had to deal with. Your husband carried on a blatant association with the mother of this boy. You planned this other woman's harm in hope that your husband would give her up. You acted like a robot, clearly detached from reality. You were virtually a doormat on which he wiped his feet. I don't consider you warrant punishment, but it was a deliberate and premeditated killing. The public must be protected." In relation to two doctors' recommendations that Mrs. Adams would need long-term psychotherapy, she was given a life sentence. This is a very difficult case, and it scarred the area's memory for many years. In the years after, there were reports of the home in which Paul lost his life was haunted, and there was many children that lived in fear of the home. One family who moved into the home reported such odd occurrences that they left the property within a week. Paul's father's home was seen on the day of the sentencing to be empty, an overgrown garden having a for sale sign planted. A neighbour reported that he had not been seen since his son's body was discovered. Paul is still remembered by those he attended school with, and it's a tragedy that marred what should have been some of their happiest days, when the summers are long and you're without the cares of the adult world. Having a friend so brutally taken in some kind of misguided attempt to win a man's affection is an exposure to the darker side of the world that's wholly premature. There is no further information to what happened to the people in this case, the children or the adults, and almost 50 years have passed since this murder happened. It's now time that we end this case and let a good friend of the show, Fern, introduce herself and tell you about her wonderful true crime podcast, Evidence of a Crime. Listen up.
Hi everyone, I'm Fern from Evidence of a Crime, a weekly true crime podcast which uses extensive research to tell the stories of missing people, unsolved, cold cases and homicide cases from around the world. I cover both lesser known and well known cases and have just launched a brand new monthly series called Seeking Justice, which raises awareness for no justice cases and supports families who are fighting for answers on social media. You can listen to Evidence of a Crime on all podcast platforms or search Evidence of a Crime to find me on social media.
As always, you can find all that you need to support her show in the show notes for this episode. As indie podcasts, we do not have the huge resources behind us that many of the bigger production companies have. Indie podcasts are made on pure effort and passion, and it's folk like you listening now who really help bring the show to life with your support. Now, at the end of every episode, I like to see if we can balance out those scales somewhat with a small act of kindness. This week, my suggestion is a little creative, but free. And what's not to like about free? Take some time, grab your phone or a snazzy camera, and go take some beautiful photographs of those you love or places that mean a lot to you. There are plenty of apps and websites that offer free printing services too, which means if you do get a great shot, you can gift your photography to your subject or someone you love. With that, go be good people, go be kind, go be safe, and most importantly, go be happy.